Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. This is your Line One co-host, Prentice Pemberton. I want to welcome everybody to a special edition of Line One. On today's show, my Line One co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard, is teaming up with me to answer your questions about anything having to do with kids' health and wellness. Today, we're opening up the phone lines for listeners to call in if you have questions or thoughts, or to share about your kids' challenges, or to share your experience with something that's worked in your life as a parent. Today, we're going to combine our experience in pediatric and medical mental health in the hope that we may provide you with accurate and helpful information about your kids' health and maybe even your own. So I want to thank Dr. Woodard for coming in on what is an off week for you, huh?
Yeah, suddenly I don't have as many obligations. I think you wanted to get into it. We're kind of changing how we're doing things a little bit.
A little bit. All right, so I'm really nervous, as you can tell, because Dr. Woodard's here sitting across from me, which, you know, he's the one that gave me the start here. And I don't think we've been on the air together since the beginning, so it's kind of like being with a rock star here. I'm a little flustered.
We need to talk about anxiety here, Prentice.
That is, it's absolutely interesting because I can feel my myself getting flush, and this doesn't happen to me. Used to happen a lot. I do appreciate, though, the chance here that you and Beattie gave me. It's been a real, like, real honor and privilege to kind of learn from you guys and figure out the ropes as I go stumbling along. So thanks. Appreciate it.
You bet. Why don't I just explain a little bit to people about what we're doing here. Several years ago, well, as long as I can remember doing the program, I've always thought there was a under-recognized appreciation for the part that psychosocial aspects of healthcare, of psychosocial aspects of our lives contribute to our physical health problems. And so I tried to integrate psychosomatic, psychosocial, psychiatric health issues on a fairly regular basis, in my own mind, maybe once a month. And then you showed up somewhere on my doorstep, kind of whining and just laying down on the carpet. But no, and
can I watch, please?
We're interested in that, and you are a specialist in the psychological, psychosocial health issues. So we started adding you into the program, and then, believe it or not, I am not going to live forever, and I'm 60, almost 69. And went to Beattie and our program director here and said, you know, I'm not going to do this forever. Let's start thinking about some transition plans, and talked to Prentice and came up with the idea that for at least several months, we're going to do every other kind of halftime programs. And in the middle of those halftime programs, throw in some open mic, open programs where we have no guest but are willing to take topics on psychosocial issues for Prentice, mental health issue, or physical health issues for myself. So that brought us to this first attempt where we're both here with the phone lines open to try to just address people's concerns as best we can, realizing that we have expertise in fairly limited areas, which makes me think about it. The other day I was listening to Warren Buffett on TV. I was listening to a Charlie Rose interview with Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. And, you know, if there's one guy who I would say is the wisest guy I know, it's got to be Warren Buffett. And he makes a big point of understanding your circle of expertise. He invests only in things he really understands. And so you can't expect any one person to have big areas of expertise. And in fact, the corollary to that whole issue is when you start getting outside of your area of expertise, you're really asking for trouble. So anyway, that's a kind of a venture into the idea that, yeah, although I'm a physician, I'm particularly good in pediatrics, and there's some subspecial areas within pediatrics that I have extensive exposure and experience to. And Prentice, you're a social worker, and your expertise is looking at the psychosocial aspects.
Really, the psychosocial aspects as far as like how the system works together. We were just talking before the show about systems perspective and people in environment and how, you know, the environment is so impactful on the child's biology. And that's where the medicine and the psychology come together a little bit. But yeah, understanding how a young person, since the focus of today's show is the young people, focusing on how their parents and their school and their social skills, their ability to learn, all those things come into play when we're considering. You can't just take a kid and put them in a vacuum. With those, you know, behaviors are not created in a vacuum. So it's important that we understand a little bigger. You can, as a physician, treat and give a pill and give a, you know, splint something or look at something with an x-ray, and then you send him home and you see him again in a month and a half. So there's a lot of, as you had a show earlier with your social worker, there's a lot of interplay that could be, you know, there's a lot of overlap between mental health and physical health, and the environment. And so that's where my expertise is. I guess that's the disclaimer for the show, is that if we give advice, it's it's not, we may be pointing you in a direction of somebody who knows more. So we're, again, encouraging folks to call in with questions about their child, either young or older, and we will answer them if we can. If we cannot, we will hopefully point you in the direction of somebody who can at least get you started. If you're going to call, I need to remind you how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. So please don't hesitate to call in if you have questions for Dr. Woodard or myself. Phone lines are open today for any questions that you have about your kid's mental or physical health. So please don't hesitate. I guess let's go ahead and start. Dr. Woodard, I guess people who have been listening to this show for a long time know about your background and your expertise. So until we get some calls coming in, why don't you give us a little bit about your background? Pediatrician, obviously, but why do you believe so strongly in the mental health piece? And
I was going to start. Well, I was born in Newark, Ohio. I'm not, you know, like anything. If you're honest about your memory, you got to be quite honest and say the way our mind works, the way our memory works, we now know is it puts together pictures that fit our framework of how the world works. And the more we recall our memories, the more they get adjusted. There's very good evidence to suggest that. And I won't get into the memory issue. What I'm doing is I'm saying what my memory is I read a book called Caring for Patients. Must have been 20 to 30 years ago, written by a guy named Alan Barbour, B-A-R-B-O-U-R. He was the outpatient director of medicine at the outpatient clinic at Stanford for something like 40 years. And for over 30 of those years, he was decided, I'm going to keep track of every patient we see as an outpatient in the clinic at Stanford University, and try to figure out why they are here. Why did they come to this healthcare facility? And it's a wonderful book. It's still available. I saw it just the other day as I was looking at some things on Amazon. But here's my recollection of what he found. About one in three people, these are adults, who ended up in his healthcare system had a purely physical problem. They had eczema. They had a heart attack. They broke their leg. About another 30% on average were there because they had no physical problem. They were depressed. They were anxious. They had psychosocial issues that were causing them to come in with some complaint. And then the other 30%, interestingly enough, were there because of a physical problem. But when you really got into it, the main reason they were there was not really the physical problem. It was the anxiety about that physical problem. It was the inability to understand why they needed to take the medication. It was depression. It was, I got this problem, but it's probably related to the fact that my wife and I don't get along very well. All right? So in that 30-year study that was reported, two out of every three people that came into the healthcare system had no, the reason was there was not a purely physical reason. And I saw just a brief blurb the other day. It suggested in pediatrics it's about 50-50. And I'll have to say I'm skeptical of that. I think it's higher than 50-50. I think it's a huge issue. One example is anxiety drives a tremendous amount of health care and health care costs. We worry about things that are pretty unusual and rare. We want lab to verify our worries. We need x-rays to feel more comfortable about things. We get overdiagnosed because our anxiety makes us act out our discomfort much greater than it really is, in various and sundry ways. And that's not to be critical. That's just the human being. That's human nature. And so part of being a physician after a long time is you begin to snuff that out. Excuse me, and you become aware of it, and you're much more interested in addressing and trying to get at the roots of that physical complaint if it doesn't really quite get explained as well as it should from as a purely physical problem.
Well, in pediatrics, those symptoms of pain, stomach aches, headaches, general feelings of being sick for kids and adolescents. Those are very often psychological in nature and anxiety related due to, I don't know the number of referrals from physicians I get, which is quite a few, where, we can't really find anything going on with this kid, but he's sick every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, like before school, he throws up physically in the trash can. So there is something wrong, but adolescence is tricky. All right, let's go ahead. We got a couple of calls, so let's go ahead and start with Laura. You're on line one with Dr. Woodard.
Hey guys, how are you?
Great.
I have been waiting a long time to get on the air in a show like this, and I really don't have a lot to say about type 1 diabetes. But what I do have to say is thank you so much for your show. A couple years ago, you had people from TrialNet talking about type 1 diabetics and how their family members may have the autoantibodies.
Yep.
And so I had myself and my son tested. And lo and behold, my youngest son had 4 out of 5 autoantibodies for type 1 diabetes. We were able to get into the study because of your show that got him on an oral insulin plan. We found out just this year, 2 weeks ago, that he is now moving fully into type 1 diabetes. But because of your show, we kept him out of ketoacidosis. He's diagnosed so early that he doesn't take insulin yet. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you are a blessing. I don't know if you know that, but you really are a blessing, at least to my family.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yes. So you need to correct me if I'm wrong about this. I'm envisioning listeners trying to figure out what the heck we're talking about here is. And so diabetes is very well validated as being an autoimmune disease. People develop antibodies, a protein against different parts of their body with autoimmune diseases. And with rheumatic fever, for example, it's against heart valves or sometimes parts of your brain. And arthritis is some of the arthritides or different parts of your joints get involved. With diabetes, there's an insulin, I think it's an antibodies against the islet cells, the cells that have the machinery to make insulin. So your body self-destructs those. And there's been some worry for a long time or some ideas for a long time that you might be able to predict who might be at risk because they've already made those antibodies. You measure them, and then you watch those people much more closely with the idea, hopefully at some point, you might interfere with that mechanism and prevent diabetes. My feeling is I don't think we're there yet, and I frankly was a little surprised when I listened to you that we're really already having people where we're really—I know there's research. I have a patient who— whose son was tested very, very early as part of a very early program looking for the antibodies. But they were just kind of said, yep, this baby has these antibodies, but we don't know what to tell you to do about them. So what I'm hearing you say is now there are people that you're enrolling in programs where you're really kind of measuring these antibodies and watching things very closely to at least make an early diagnosis and perhaps have some better outcomes.
Yes. He took an oral insulin that would hopefully train the body not to attack it.
Wow.
And we don't know if he got the sugar pill or the insulin.
Right.
But what we do know is every 6 months we travel to Seattle, and he took an oral insulin test, test.
Yep.
And I'm sorry, oral glucose tolerance test.
Right.
And he failed the last one, and we repeated it, and he failed. And they were like, time to see your endocrinologist. Just get going for it here, right now.
Right.
And we went to the endocrinologist, and he's like, well, your hemoglobin A1C is normal. Your post-lunch blood sugar is normal, but this oral glucose test is really the only indicator that you have type 1 diabetes coming on.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's just, it was such an amazing show, and it absolutely changed our lives.
Wow.
I appreciate the call, Laura. That's it's good feedback. It's good to hear when it makes a difference. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Good luck.
Take care.
Bye.
Let's keep going. We have Caroline. You're on line one with Dr. Woodard. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, sir. Three things. I'll give my medical question at the very end, and it's for pediatrics. Number one, Phil Johnson, who was a psychiatrist here for a number of years, he and his wife have retired. He mentioned one time, or maybe she's the one that told me, that he started out as a GP and saw the impact of the emotion on the physical and went back to get his psychiatric training. I was going to mention also, Dr. Woodard, the value of your program, if I remember correctly. Your program came in third in the nation in one of the award categories.
I think it was a state program. It was not a national program evaluation.
Yeah, well, state's good enough for mine. give it to me out of Anchorage. I'd be happy. The third thing, Warren Buffett, one of the smartest things I ever heard anyone say, he said about 2 years ago, and that was that we either do or do not have the luck of the womb.
Yep.
Which I think is something that we all should remember about ourselves and each other.
Yep.
And I will tell you, as a 73-year-old mother of kids that are 53 and 50, that age does get better in that there are some ameliorating circumstances to counter the loss of memory, et cetera. And the reason, I think, from my perspective, is we get more ornery, and we tend to be forgiven more. And the final thing is I've seen and I read somewhere about children, young children, needing eyeglasses more, that our kids are not getting out enough for their eye muscles to be exercised, and apparently the closing door is between 5 and 6 years old, that they're not getting the wide, medium, and near muscle exercise, and that's why we're getting a higher percentage, and apparently it was quite surprisingly high of young kids that have to wear glasses forever.
Wow. Yeah, you got me on that one. I have not heard that. I don't think there's any question in my mind that we see kids needing glasses more. And I would say my experience is like autism, like many things, we're better at finding it. We spend a lot of effort in pediatrics trying to identify kids very, very early for a number of eye diseases to try to, again, interfere in the natural history and slow things down or improve them or sometimes even cure them. So I would have probably argued that I don't know whether we're seeing more or we're just finding them better and having better diagnostic techniques. But I can believe that your point is we're spending more time indoors, so we don't. It's another reason for not getting out in nature and moving around.
Yeah, I think that is certainly something we're more worried about our children, something happening to them, and I can certainly understand that.
Yep.
But at the same time, the issue has to come from the standpoint of what parents are told before they have the child, because I know they used to do a lot. And mothers, my mother was in the hospital 2 weeks after I was born, and now it's, what,
right.
48 hours at the most?
Right.
So
yep.
I'm not sure how much education parents are getting, and that would certainly be one piece that I would think they'd want to know about, if, in fact, everything bears out.
Yep, yep.
All righty, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Thank you.
Thanks, Caroline. For those who might be tuning in late, joining me in studio today as a special guest is my Line 1 co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Woodard, today we're opening up the phone lines to hear your questions about kids' physical and emotional health. In addition to listening, we'll also attempt to answer your questions to the best of our ability, or at least point you in a direction that you can begin to get some answers. So let's keep going with the phone calls. I do want to remind folks, you can reach us at 550-8433. You can get us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. Right now, Devin, you're on line one with Dr. Woodard. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Much more simple question and probably less involved, but my first child is 3 years old, and she took on to potty training really well about 9 months ago. It was a very fast transition, and she was really proud of herself and had very little accidents at first and then had no accidents for the past 6 months. And then as of about 2 weeks ago, it's every day. And I didn't know, I don't know what to do, and just wondering if you guys had any suggestions.
Is she dry at night?
I don't know when she is becoming wet, but yeah, she's dry at night and then lays there in it in the morning, whether I woke her up or not. And so I don't know if she knows she's doing it.
Right. And she's roughly three and a half, you said, right now?
Yeah, she's three. And so for since just a little over two is when she started, and she did really well for a long, long time. And it really upsets her. And, you know, I don't know if putting her back in a diaper is a good idea, or if continuing to explore, you know, just having her wet every day.
So there's two big thoughts about this. Is it a physical problem or is it a psychosocial problem? That's the first thing I go with. Most of the time it's a psychosocial problem, not a physical problem. But let's try to get the physical issues out of the way, and then I'll let Prentice give you his 10 cents worth on this. She having fever. The reason I ask about nighttime, if she's dry all night, all the time, then that takes a lot of physical things off the table. And if she has no fever, no pain, no discomfort with urinating, then it also makes it highly unlikely that we're dealing with some physical problem. There's always that issue, is there some physical thing? So sometimes the best advice that you'll see written a number of places, make sure a physician takes a look at them first. But given, you know, if she's dry at night, she seems to be unhappy with the fact that she wets, she knows what's going on, she understands it, she's upset about it, I doubt that there's a physical issue going on. So now I'm going to pass you over to Prentice.
Yeah, excellent. And that's why I thought it was so interesting that both you guys are on.
Yep. Well, that's part of the reason we're doing it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, Devin, in my experience, I've worked with a lot of kids who have had bedwetting issues in a variety of different stages in their life, all the way up to 15 or 16 years old, which is obviously something you're not dealing with right now. But any changes in the environment, any kind of illness or not getting enough sleep, stress at school, anything that she might be dealing with, you're probably going to it's not a huge surprise that a three-year-old would kind of go up and down. I had one of mine when was four, when he sort of quit doing the wet in the bed at night, and then that cleared up, I mean, for a while, and then consistently it was great, and then all of a sudden she couldn't do that. So we went back to pull-ups for a while until it just sort of she outgrew it. So I wouldn't get too stressed out about it at 3 years old, and I wouldn't make a big deal out of it, and kind of follow her lead on, you know, do you want to get some, you know, some pull-ups or some nighttime, you know, underwear, and let her kind of participate in that decision.
Okay. Well, thank you, guys.
All right.
I would also just echo, I'm sure parents will agree, a lot of positive reinforcement. If she makes some effort, she's interested, then reward the effort, not the outcomes. I think is a very good general principle for parenting kids and athletes.
Shaming doesn't work, right? Yeah. Making them feel bad or hurting their feelings, which is not obviously anything that hopefully you're doing, but parents get frustrated too, and you got to change the sheets again, and you know, even that makes a kid really kind of feel that. So stay positive and reinforce, as Dr. Woodard said.
Cool. Thank you, guys.
All right, thanks, Devin.
I think I'm going to add one more thing. I think it's important for parents to realize nighttime bedwetting is a distinctly different issue than daytime wetting of pants. Nighttime is usually much later. Boys, 10% of boys who enter school, it's first grade, are still nighttime bedwetters. And for most pediatricians, we think of that as a sleep disorder. They get into very, very, very deep sleep. So kids who are hard to arouse, very deep sleepers, have a family history of bedwetting, more often boys than girls, that's not as much under their control as you might think.
One of the things you want to look for in bedwetting, if you're looking for psychological reasons, is a change in that behavior, that sudden, that lasts for a while. Is there something going on, like anxiety or, you know, bullying, or are they trying to hold that, you know, for control? So if there is a sudden change, then you definitely want to evaluate what's happening in your child's life and look for signs of stress or causes that could create that significant a change. So appreciate the call, Devin. That's a good question and one that a lot of parents have. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll keep going with this. We're almost up to the halfway point in our show, but let's go ahead and go with Kathy. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I was calling because my granddaughter gets these spots all over her body. And my daughter has taken her to the doctors, and they said that they look like hives, but we don't really know what's causing them.
Right.
She does play hockey, and so we kind of thought, well, maybe it, you know, could have been something from hockey. She's very sensitive to the point that she can get herself worked up pretty doggone good, enough to make herself throw up. For instance, I had her at Alyeska once, and the mother died. We were watching a movie, and the mother died, and all of a sudden she wanted her mother. She called home, and as soon as she did, after that, she threw up. And occasionally she'll do that at night, but not really sick. And then she'll go to bed, and she'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
So we are trying to figure out where these spots are coming from.
Okay.
So I guess we want to know a direction.
Yeah, so hives are intermittent, move around, bumps on your skin of various sizes that itch. And the key thing is they come and go, and they move around. They are due to the release of histamine primarily, is the major reason. We have cells that have some histamine in them, and when those cells are perturbed, they release histamine and cause hives. A misconception is that it's always allergy, and that is not necessarily true. There are physical hives or physical urticarias, and sometimes with sweat, sometimes with heat, sometimes with cold, sometimes after respiratory illnesses, people will break out in hives. Different medications, the narcotics are notorious. When people take narcotics, they may break out in hives. It's not an allergy. It's just the way the narcotics work. So sometimes medications will do this. It is true that people who have a tendency to allergies may have hives more, but it is not always true that an allergy is triggering it. And then it gets even more complex because if you do allergy tests, the allergy tests say you have an antibody that suggests you are allergic or you have sensitization. I'm choosing my terms very carefully here because it gets important. You're sensitized and you may have symptoms when you're around that allergen. So if you got a skin test to cats and peanuts and birch, then we can tell you got those, but nothing about that test tells us what symptoms you're going to have. And so the real best way to figure these things out is historically what's happening. What are you doing? Is it consistently doing anything in particular? And if it's intermittent hives, like it sounds like she has, it could be a physical urticaria, which is just due to exercise or heat. If it's every time she eats peanuts, then it's probably peanut allergy. If it's every time she plays with a cat, then it's probably cat. And the allergy test can help you identify some of that. But really, the history is extremely important on this. So for many people, it's not anaphylaxis. That's a common misunderstanding. It is true that anaphylaxis often has hives, but most people with hives do not have anaphylaxis, and it's not necessarily dangerous. It's just inconvenient, and an antihistamine, particularly the non-sedating antihistamines like Zyrtec and Claritin, can be very helpful, or trying to adjust whatever the factor is that may be triggering those things.
Okay.
Bummer, dude. Everybody wants to know exactly what the reason is. And hives are one to drive even allergists, maybe they don't drive them crazy because they understand what's going on. But you can spend a lot of money trying to figure them out when it's maybe not worthwhile.
We're kind of thinking her playing hockey and sweating, but we're not totally sure.
Yeah, it may be the exercise and getting heat. And by the way, I doubt that emotions cause it. I mean, that's a thing that I started in practice thinking that was possible, but I think that's not impossible, but think it's unlikely, even though she's obviously a very emotional little girl. I understand that, but I don't think that's the trigger.
So would she take the Claritin and stuff before she exercised? Would that help her?
Yep. It'll absolutely almost guarantee you prevent them from happening. I mean, again, you got to be careful about guarantees in medicine, but the right amount beforehand should block that effect. And nice thing about Claritin and Zyrtec is theoretically very little, if any, gets into your brain, so you don't get sedated like Benadryl and some of those things. They're extremely safe medications to take.
So how long before would she take that?
I would try to take it maybe an hour or so beforehand. They start working pretty quick.
All right. And actually, the doctor that she went to, I said, I think they mentioned that. They thought it might have been exercise-induced and to take it. But she's still getting them. But she's not taking it like taking it after she gets the hive.
All allergy medicines work much better if you take them before exposure. Yep.
Okay, we'll try that.
Okie doke. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right. Thanks, Kathy. One of the only experiences I ever had with hives and itches were from like a late night college freshman year. Didn't get my paper done, and I was so stressed out, and I couldn't go to bed, and I was like itching all over. And I called my mom at 3 o'clock in the morning, standing at a payphone out in the hall, and she said, "Just take the F, and then like take it again next year." And I was like, "Really?" And I went home and slept like a baby. So. I think there's clearly some anxiety there. All right, we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. Joining me in studio today is Line One co-host Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're opening up the call lines to answer your questions about kids' physical and emotional health. You can reach us at 550-8433. Or toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, Dr. Woodard and I will continue to answer your questions about kids' health and wellness. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my special guest today is my Line 1 co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, we're opening up the call lines to answer your questions about kids' physical and emotional health. You can email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8. So if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we won't be able to accept phone calls. So, yeah, over the next 20 minutes or so, please go ahead and call in soon. We can get you on, hopefully, before, it gets kind of jammed up at the end. So get your calls in early, and we'll get you on the air. Okay, let's go ahead. We have a comment. John, you're on Line 1. Go ahead. You have a comment about hives.
Yes, hello, sirs. So listening to that last quick conversation, so I just wanted to add to that discussion is my son, who's middle school, earlier on in his life had a wasp venom reaction that was very, very critical, and he had to travel with EpiPens all the time for his outdoor activities. But he also had an extreme heat and cold allergy where he would be very hive reactive to weather.
That's called, if I understand what you're saying, it's called a physical urticaria, and it's not uncommon at all. I tell you, from a pediatrician standpoint, I probably see somewhere in the neighborhood of once a month, we'll see kids who get a viral respiratory illness and they'll have hives daily, and they'll have hives daily for a week or two, as long as a month or so. And that's another very common thing that happens. And those daily hives, you can almost be sure it's not some allergy trigger unless there's a clear, you're doing the same thing every day to cause it. I just wanted to bring up another very, very common reason for that. And usually within a month or so, the hives go away. Unfortunately, in adults, my understanding is the chronic hives, after when they get started, are unfortunately have a tendency to be there for long, long periods of time.
Yeah, it's just a thing people should think and consider, too, because it took us a little bit to figure that one out on the cold and hot.
Yep.
That was an interesting fact.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You bet.
All right. Thanks for the call, John. Let's keep going with the phone calls. We have a question about anxiety. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. My niece has issues with anxiety, and her mother is not well emotionally. And when my niece was young, she was a normal child, outgoing and very happy and stuff. But now, over the years, she's developed a lot of fears and phobias about, just going out and being around people. And we believe that has a lot to do with her interactions with her mother and stuff. But
right.
And she would, in the dealing with this issue, her mother would take her from doctor to doctor until she found someone who would agree that there was something wrong with her child. And she's getting prescriptions, medications for this, this condition, but she's not being given any therapy, any kind of, and by therapy, I mean, practices she can engage in to help desensitize her, you know, to her phobias and stuff.
Right, right.
And I was just wondering if there's any possible validity to this course of action, and if not, any suggestions you might have would be helpful.
Yep. All right, so I'm going to jump in from a medical standpoint and then let Prentice either stomp on my suggestions or, or come up with some better ideas. So a couple of thoughts. One, the environment may truly have had an impact on her anxiety in causing it, or it could have exacerbated a genetic predisposition. Those are two very easy ways for me to understand that. And two, the treatment, the best treatment, the evidence-based treatment, the high-quality evidence is that counseling, psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy in particular, is the treatment of choice for anxiety. Medications are, in my experience, generally pretty effective. And at times, you need to do the medications to allow psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy to proceed. But anytime I do that, it's with the understanding is this is not generally the long-term answer. And I say generally because every patient is different and every situation is different. But the overall general, my understanding of the treatment would be counseling. And I'm going to tell you the reason for that is the medications don't change anything. They control your symptoms, and if you want to get better, you've got to reprogram, in my mind, how I think, how your brain's working. the way we learn behaviors is from experience. And then the more we do those behaviors, the more reinforced they get. And I'm talking about physical reinforcement of wiring in our brain. And it gets better and better and better and better. And it gets harder and harder and harder and harder to change it. So, but we can. There's good evidence that you can. Medications don't do that. All right, Prentice, what did I do wrong?
No, that was all perfect. I think one of the things to think about, and how old is the child?
Well, she's 19 now.
Oh, 19 now. Okay, so grown. So she's kind of got the insight, even though brain development's not done till about 27, the frontal lobe of the brain. But yeah, early childhood exposure. One thing we probably won't get to is the ACEs, studies where they talked a lot about the more exposure you have to anxiety and domestic violence and addiction, the more likely, the correlation is direct with mental health problems. So any, brains are wired based on usage. There's 12-year-olds all over, in war-torn countries that are carrying rifles and ready to kill people. And that's not how, my 11-year-old acts. So if your brain is sort of wired to be anxious all the time, it's going to be really good at doing that thing, which is what Dr. Woodard was talking about. It's going to be good at worrying. It's going to question, are things going to be okay? And then if you don't have proper attachment from childhood, it complicates it more, and then you get trust issues and all the things that go along with that. So a 19-year-old going through a lot, and a lot of things are going to be changing for her. So it's important that she gained that awareness.
And her mother doesn't feel like there's, she's a part of the issue, and so it's hard to. It's just a real difficult situation.
Yep.
But you basically confirmed everything that I thought I knew.
That's why you may need more therapy, different kinds of therapy. Sometimes you need a family therapy or somebody to address mom's issues, and then this girl needs some help. And I want to point out that I think it's really important that a lot of anxiety is coexistent with or with depression, or depression is right down the road here, and that is the most common chronic disease affecting manhood, all of us, and has significant morbidities and problems associated with it. So I would encourage as best you can, and I know it can be difficult to address her problem.
Yeah, well, thank you.
You bet.
All right, bye.
All right, thanks for the call. One more thing to add to that is exercise, good sleep, hygiene, routines, getting into like a progression, your week. So all those things are good. Anxiety and depression feed on each other. You're worried too much, so you don't get stuff done. So you feel like a failure. So you don't. Then you worry more because you have more stuff to worry.
You don't socialize.
Yeah, you isolate more and more. So there's lots of things. But medication can act as sort of like to lift the fog, so that you can sort of see where you're headed. And without a goal, without being able to see where you're going, that depression or that anxiety can become really debilitating to the point where, you just don't want to hear again, well, why don't you just get up and go for a walk? You just don't want to hear that again because you know that information. If you know the difference between good advice and bad advice, you probably don't need advice. Medications certainly have a place. It's important to be involved with some kind of therapist and medical provider. We have another caller calling in. Go ahead. You're on line one with Dr. Woodard.
Hi.
Hello.
My name is Ann.
Okay.
Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just listening to the last caller, and I will be right up front. I have anxiety, and I do have depression.
Yep.
They're no fun. I also have two really amazing kids.
Yep.
And we are a military family, so we move a lot. So there's a lot of challenges. Every time you move, you start again. And they have been really awesome. But they also now have some struggles. And on a bad day, one of my kids and I can feed off of one another's anxiety. And I try really hard not to pass that on to my kids. But I need other adults to realize there are a lot of us out here who know what our struggles are. We're not trying to poison our kids with our struggles. We know the research. Some of us feel like we're just weighted down by the research. We're just trying to give our kids a good life. And sometimes what we need instead of blame is just, hey, can I borrow your kids for an afternoon and go do this thing? Can I model some good behavior for them? Do you just need a break? Sometimes it's just, if you want something to have a positive outcome, you need to be a part of it. And I really need other people, other adults, to hear that. You just by a kind word or gesture, you can make that outcome that afternoon, that week, a lot better.
All right, Ann. Appreciate the call. I think what you're talking about is having, one of the things that's really important in life for all of us is a support network and a group of people that you can call and rely on when things aren't great. I think the vast majority of people in the United States will suffer some sort of anxiety or depression episode at some point in their lifetime. And if you haven't ever been through it, it's really hard to understand it and to make sense of it. So, it's important to have a community of people. It's also, I saw an article I read about this lady who felt like a terrible mom all the time. And she was talking to a therapist about how she just fed them macaroni and cheese and she only let them watch movies. And her therapist reframed it for her and said, in the worst time that you've ever had in your life, you were able to feed your children and to look out for their most basic needs, to keep them alive, to give them an opportunity to be successful when you're not doing so well. So sometimes it is just getting through the day and taking care of your kids in the best way you can. And depression and anxiety are real things, and they impact a lot of people. There's none of us who don't know somebody who deals with anxiety and depression. So, Ann, thanks for the call, and I appreciate you pointing that out.
Thank you.
All right. We'll just keep rolling with the phone calls at this point. Sam, you're on line one. You have a question about anxiety?
Yes, we have an adolescent daughter who was diagnosed with anxiety and depression, and we ended up going outside for treatment and found that she had severe OCD that really wasn't apparent to us.
Right.
And we also found that there really isn't anyone up here who is skilled at all in exposure response prevention, and OCD is very treatable. We over Christmas break, she went out to California for 3 weeks to an intensive program at the Gateway Institute south of L.A. and was very, very successful. Her therapist that we have that's out of state that Skypes with her to do her exposure work said that would have taken her an hour before she went outside. They were able to finish in 3 minutes once she got back. And I wish that you guys would do a program about OCD.
Yeah, that's a great idea, because as soon as I saw OCD treatment, my eyes lit up, because it's a confounding thing, and it's a difficult thing to treat. And I think you're right. I'm sure there's some people that specialize in it. It's a branch of anxiety disorders, and you know, the treatments vary greatly. But I'd be interested. You have Sam, you have our website. I mean, our email address. I give it out. If you could go ahead and send me that information on the treatment program, I'd like to check that out and do some more research on what that is, because I see it a lot in my office, and it's a confounding thing, and it seems to respond somewhat to medication. So, Dr. Woodard, what do you know? How much do you see anxiety in your practice, or the OCD sort of behaviors, and what do you know about treatment approaches?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't want to pretend. I agree with you. I think of it as part of the anxiety milieu, as a different form of anxiety. It's in that same category when I look at it, and I definitely see it in kids. And my answer is I don't give it enough concern, or I'm missing it, or I'm not seeing the kind of individual where it's really causing them a lot of trouble. I definitely have had kids with OCD. I often look at it as, like I said, as anxiety. I'm treating it and recommending treatment much like I would talk about anxiety. I'm not skilled to tell you what's the best current treatment, but I would go with generally, you know, some psychological treatment is my frame of mind. But I'd also comment to listeners that all of these disorders, anxiety, depression, OCD, are a somewhat like a bell-shaped curve. There are people who have a desire to have right and left socks in their drawer, and yet it does not affect their life one iota, and they don't need anything. You know, it's how much it's interfering with your life, I think, and I'm here to be corrected, because it's important for me to learn too. But I think that's part and parcel of any illness. This is true of allergy. Just because you have allergies doesn't mean you need anything. It depends on how much it's causing you problems. And so I want listeners to realize that there's a lot of variation within each of these disorders that we're talking about. Some can be debilitating. Some can be hardly worth discussing.
If you have to leave go back to your house 7 times, to check your locks and to go through and out the garage door, and it takes you 40 minutes to get out of the garage and to work, then it's very intrusive in your life. If you need to flick the light switch twice every time you go out of the house, that's not very debilitating. It's a quirk maybe versus actual OCD, but OCD can be very, very frustrating. A lot of kids, I don't think, younger people in particular, they don't like to own up to it and talk to it. And I think that's why a lot of it's missed, as I find out after I've been seeing a kid you know, 3 or 4 months. He's like, hey, I do this thing with, I got to count, you know, to 12 and smooth this thing so it's just right. And I'm like, what? Like, that's relevant information. Why didn't you share that with me a bit earlier? But they're kind of embarrassed about it. So
it's about 10% or so of the population. I mean, it's a significant portion. And you're right. But a lot of times, at least from a physician standpoint, we're not even asking about whether you've got those kind of symptoms unless something comes up or I observe something in the office.
Yeah, people are coming to you to see about a thing, and that's what you're looking for. So appreciate the call, Sam. Thanks for taking the time.
What was the name of the therapy again? I'd like to look it up myself.
Yes, it's exposure response prevention.
Okay.
And it is basically this gold standard for OCD treatment.
Hmm.
There's also the International Institute for OCD.
Hmm.
And it's very well explained there as well.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for the information.
It sounds like a good show for coming up this spring, so I appreciate the call. Mary, you're on line one with Dr. Woodard. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hey, Mary.
Okay, here's my question. My daughter was recently diagnosed. She's 8 years old with dermographitis.
Yeah, dermographia. Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
She gets a histamine reaction when she eats certain foods. Her ears turn bright red and get very itchy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point is being made, she is not allergic to these foods. It's just certain foods. I'm keeping a food diary at the moment, and it's tomatoes, luncheon meats, processed meats, that sort of thing. She'll get this reaction. So I guess my question is this. It just seems counterintuitive to me that if her body is giving this reaction, yet she's not allergic, that it's still okay to keep feeding her those foods?
Yeah, right. Let me ask. So to me, dermatographism means if I take a pen that I have in my hand right now, a writing pen, and I take the writing part out of it, I click the pen so it doesn't, and I just stroke her skin, she gets a hive in exactly the place where I stroked her. If I strike for 3 inches or so, she'll get a hive there that's 3 inches long. That, to me, is dermatographism. And I might be wrong in that there is broader definition of it, but if I eat something and my ears flush, then I don't think of that as dermatographism. The Asian population has a gene where they drink alcohol and they can get flushed in their face. That is not an allergic reaction, and it is not dermatographism. It's, in a sense, a chemical reaction to things. If you eat a can of tuna fish, some canned tuna fish has lots of histamine in it, and so you can start itching and get flushed. So I just because I'm a physician and you want to get your words right, in a sense, I agree with you. I'm not sure that that's dermatographism that you're describing.
I agree. I couldn't understand the relationship between the two.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So
it just didn't make sense to me.
Right. I think, we may be talking about two different things, but the overall issue is if it's not hurting you physically to the point where it interferes with your life or causes long-term problems, then it may be okay to continue to do it, to eat that particular food. I think it have to be individualized. In a sense, I can agree with you that I don't think I'd push something that's causing some physical symptoms if I didn't have to.
Okay, thanks for the call.
We have
about a minute and 10
wow.
seconds left. So
wow.
next week, I appreciate you coming in, Dr. Woodard, on your week off. What do you got going next week?
Well, next week we're going to return to some cancer issues. We're going to talk about gynecological cancers with Dr. Joni Hope, whose whole specialty involves around that. She's been on in the past. She's an excellent, excellent physician in dealing with gynecologic cancers. And we'll talk about prevention, detection, and treatment.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming in today, and that was a lot of fun. Dr. Woodard's next show is Monday, February 13th at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. Eric Bork is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for taking the time to join Dr. Woodard and I today on Line 1. It was fun. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.